you know, if we were all on healing journeys, we probably wouldn't need to talk about emotional intelligence. It almost feels to me sometimes that the emotional intelligence conversation is because we can't talk about the real stuff. So yeah. We're like, and this real stuff over here that you're not really aware of and that you haven't healed is actually causing a lot of damage in the world. And so we're going to like try to get you an emotional intelligence coach, and we're going to try to do all these things so you can, again, white knuckle some changes and try to show up in the world in a more effective way. But we haven't gotten down to what's really driving that behavior. And you haven't either. It's in the shadows. So often it's so deep in the shadows that we don't see it, and we don't see that we don't see it.
Welcome, EI enthusiasts, to the Living and Leading with Emotional Intelligence podcast by Emotional Intelligence Magazine. Emotional Intelligence Magazine, or EIM Plus, as it's known for short, is a one-stop resource for anyone looking to learn more about emotional intelligence. In addition to articles, videos, and recommended books to help you develop and expand your EI, EIM Plus offers a platform for EI coaches and specialists so they can connect with individuals who are ready to take their life or business to the next level. Learn more by visiting ei-magazine.com. That's ei-magazine.com. Or follow us on Instagram at the_EI_magazine. You can find these links and more in today's show notes. I'm your host, Brittany Nicole, and today I have the pleasure of introducing you to Scott Allender. He is an expert in global leadership, in organizational development, and co-host of the Evolving Leadership podcast, and most recently published his new book, The Enneagram of Emotional Intelligence: A Journey to Personal and Professional Success. When I saw his book, I was really excited to read it because while I've heard of the Enneagram and I know a little bit about what it's about, I mean, I know it's got to do with numbers and okay, so I really don't know what it's about, but I got to understand it and how it's so interconnected to emotional intelligence. So let's dive in, shall we? Here is Scott Allender. Scott, welcome to the Living and Leading with Emotional Intelligence podcast. It is a pleasure to have you on. I'm so excited to talk about your, I'm going to say newly released book, because by the time this airs, it will be out. And we're going to talk a little bit more about it. But before we do that, like, I just want to welcome you. And I would love for you to kind of share with our listeners how you fell into this space. Like, what are you doing now? But how did you get into the space of emotional intelligence and the Enneagram?
Well, thanks, Brittany. It's a pleasure to be here. And thanks for having me on. So yeah, I've been working in the leadership space for many, many years, and following research on the importance of self-awareness and its impact on our effectiveness, both professionally, but also personally. So as part of the work that I've done, I pursued various psychometrics tools to add to my sort of toolkit and the ways that I could help people. And I got certified in tools like Myers-Briggs and Hogan and the emotional intelligence system that I framed the book around. But along the way, I was also looking into the Enneagram and being sort of introduced to this system. And I it took me a while to find my Enneagram personality type. Once I did, it really kind of became something that kind of an all-consuming endeavor for me, and became the most transformative personally for me in terms of the tool helping me to get underneath what is often sort of unconscious motivations and parts of ourselves that we don't really even recognize, like blind spots of ourselves. And so as I was working with individuals and doing continued research in emotional intelligence, I sort of found that the data around the progress we're making wasn't very strong. In other words, you know, I read some research that was published in Tasha Yurick's book, Insight, a few years back. And I think she had partnered with Cornell to do this study. And it revealed that only sort of 13 to 15% of people are truly self-aware. And so I'm going, well, we have all this increasing amounts of data about how emotional intelligence is so important. And yet the cornerstone of which, self-awareness, is still missing. And there's a disconnect there. There's a problem there. And so I'm sort of personally going through this journey of self-discovery through the Enneagram, it just occurred to me that I think the reason, or one of the reasons, is, and we can talk a lot more about this because I think there's actually multiple reasons, but one of the primary reasons is that I think at a fundamental level, most people are on autopilot and we are walking through our days in a sort of half awake, half asleep state of being. And when somebody reflects back to us an emotional intelligence profile that we've, you know, maybe we completed a profile and we sit with a coach, we then try to start making adjustments from the place of ourselves that we already know about and still aren't getting to all the hidden stuff. And so I wanted to join this whole thing up. And that's what I've attempted to do in my book.
So you're saying as you were kind of just going through this process, you started to discover that within yourself. Like, I'm curious what sparked your initial quest in this space of emotionally intelligent practices, or I guess self-awareness practices. I know you said you were in leadership for a while, but was there something that there was like a passion that was pre-existing, or did you just fall into the space?
I've always had a sort of curiosity in the space of what motivates people and, you know, why very brilliant people might unintentionally be very, you know, engage in harmful behaviors, why we all sort of make decisions and choices we live to regret, why we have interactions with certain people that, you know, leave us frustrated and we can't make sense of it. So I've always had this sort of draw. And then for me personally, the story with the Enneagram, one of the things that happened is I was part of a men's group that my friend was running as part of his PhD program. And he was trying to work with men on how to reframe how we connect to our own emotions and talk about emotions with one another and just in life, right? So kind of men that might kind of approach relationships differently by getting more connected with their emotions and being able to express them. I'm oversimplifying it, but that was kind of the idea. And day one of this sort of what was going to be like a 12-week workshop every week, all we had to do was sort of look on the wall and identify one of eight core emotions that we were feeling at the moment. And we didn't have to contextualize any of it. And we just named the feeling and then moved to the next person. Or it could be more than one feeling. And I was the last one to go because I sat there in that room and I was struggling to figure out, what is it I'm feeling? And why is it that I'm actually probably more connected to what I think other people are going to say about how they're feeling, but yet not really understanding what I'm feeling? So at the end of that night, I went home and I reopened an Enneagram book that I had been starting. It was The Complete Enneagram by Beatrice Chestnut. And I got to a place where she described my particular type in a way that I'd never heard described before. And it was like she'd been watching me my whole life. It was so uncanny and so connected to the depths of I think lots of what I'd kind of repressed in myself, that it just sent me down this trail of like, this is possibly the missing link. So I think what I would say about bringing those two together is that the Enneagram reveals to us that our personas in many ways are these sort of masks that we wear to face the world. So we learn early in life that our authentic way of being is probably not going to keep us safe and secure and help us get love and all the things that we want. And so we over-identify with one of these nine personality archetypes as a way to feel safe and get our needs met. And then we kind of lose our most authentic selves behind the mask over a number of years. And that's all that's kind of left. So much of the authentic parts of ourselves are covered up by these personalities that we wear. And again, as I started to say a moment ago, if we then engage in a tool like emotional intelligence, somebody says, okay, you're a leader, you need to develop self-awareness. We try, but we try from the mask, right? We try by trying to make adjustments and well, let me tilt the mask this way, or let me, apply more blusher on the mask. Let me do more of this or less of this. And we try to white knuckle our way through behavioral changes. And we miss the point, which is, I think we first have to go deeper within to discover these authentic parts of ourselves that we kind of hid away from others and ourselves. And that became a really important part of my personal journey, to get reconnected to these emotions that, in my story, as I talk about a bit in the book, I grew up with a narrative that I internalized that my own identity and personal feelings didn't matter so much. And what really mattered is what I could achieve. And I set about living that persona, that identity out in the world, until all of this sort of came to fruition. And I discovered I want to recover what's underneath the mask. And that's kind of a big premise of the book, is one of the things missing from the emotional intelligence conversation is excavating the lost parts of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. You talk early on in the introduction. So first, let me let the listeners know, the title of your book is The Enneagram of Emotional Intelligence, A Journey to Personal and Professional Success. And I'll make sure to put the link and everything in the show notes. But I love how you talk about, and I know this wasn't your story, but the Enneagram teacher, Ian Cron, or is it Cron?
Cron. Mm-hmm.
He talks about Pinocchio being his favorite spiritual book.
Mm-hmm.
And you break that down and explain why, and the whole journey of that. I would love for you to kind of reiterate that to the listeners, because I had never thought of Pinocchio that way, ever.
Yeah. I hadn't either, but once you kind of do, it kind of all comes together, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So essentially, Pinocchio wanting to be a real boy, but he sets out and goes through all these sorts of journeys. He has all this sort of mischief, and he, you know, throws a brick through a church window, and he does all sorts of stuff trying to live out and enjoy life and find all of its pleasures, only to find himself obviously completely broken at the end, for lack of better terms. And he, while this happens, Geppetto goes out to look for him. And so Pinocchio then heads out to look for Geppetto, and in the search winds up in the belly of the beast, in Monstro the whale. Now what happens next is that, he essentially dies in there. And in the process, essentially what Cron gets at is that it's the symbolic process of going into the dark shadow of the whale and sort of dying to the false self, which was all of the sort of personality. And only then is he resurrected by the blue fairy. And when he awakens from that process, he finds that he actually is a real boy. So all the things that Pinocchio was pursuing to try to feel real was all false stuff. And it was he literally had to sort of die to the false self in order to recover the true self and become real. And that is why when Ian taught that story, that's why he shared, you know, when he shared that was his favorite sort of spiritual story, and connected it to the Enneagram. And that's what's needed. And I think that's so much of what's been missing from emotional intelligence conversations, and why we don't really make much progress, because we don't get to have those kinds of conversations, especially in a work setting, right? I can't go into a company and say, all right, here's the deal. We all got to go into Monstro the Whale. But in some way, when I do teach and work and coach with people, without getting too sort of, you know, spiritual or woo-woo about it, that is the work that I'm pointing to.
Mm-hmm.
That's mm-hmm. really what has to happen.
It's ego death, essentially,
yes.
is what you're doing. Yes. And since I've stepped into that space wholeheartedly now in the spiritual space, all of that makes sense. Before, I would have totally dismissed it, rejected it. And I think it's because, like you said, our society is pretty much structured like Pleasure Island. Like, this mm-hmm. is what life is supposed to be about. And if you're not enjoying it, then you need to figure out how to enjoy it, because this is what mm-hmm. it's about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And those who are in search of themselves and contentment within are looked at as foolish and crazy. But then when you do it, you realize, yeah, this is so liberating. And that's really hard for people to understand because, like you said, they're operating from the mask. Of course, it's going to be uncomfortable. You have to take the mask off first. You have to become vulnerable to that. I love how you also talk about the perception people have of emotional intelligence in particular. If this person agrees with me, if I think they're a nice, good person, therefore they must be emotionally intelligent. And if they go against what I say or have another opinion or I dislike them, then clearly they lack emotional intelligence. As a practitioner myself, TikTok was brutal the first few weeks that I jumped on until I realized like I can't let the opinions of others impact my work. But people would say, oh, I thought you were a spiritual emotional intelligence specialist. Like, would a spiritual emotional intelligence specialist say that? But like you talk about in the book, it's often a reflection of them.
Yeah, so much of what irritates us in another is a projection of the denied self of who we are. And it's also these expectations we carry about what we want from other people relative to what will serve our own egos best. But yeah, I think that the whole term has been a bit appropriated, where emotional intelligence isn't really understood in its depths. And like you were saying, we attribute it to my personal like and affection for you versus what it really is. And what the Enneagram also shows to us about what it is. You know, we say emotional intelligence, but it's more than just emotions. It's the combination and interplay of what our feelings are telling us, but also what our bodies are telling us, and the quality of our thinking.
Yeah.
And from an Enneagram perspective, it shows you that you have one dominant preference to either bodily sensation, emotional experience, or cognition. And that's where we tend to start from. And I won't go through and try to teach the whole Enneagram on this podcast, but we overuse one of those intelligences and get the other ones are out of balance. And what we need to do is bring them all back together. In fact, so much of the feelings we experience originate with body, right? So there's a process that's always going on called interoception. And what it is these signals that are coming to us from our organs, right? They're always sending signals to the brain, and our brains are interpreting those signals. Am I okay? Is everything functioning well? Am I able to regulate everything okay? But also just, you know, every physical experience we have, our bodies send a signal. They go up, our brains interpret the meaning of those signals. Sometimes a big emotional construct happens as a result of that. So all three are always at play, you know, the physical signals, you know, sometimes we feel a big feeling and the truth is our bodies are just depleted. You know, we might think we're particularly upset with somebody or mad about some circumstance when really we haven't been sleeping well, we haven't been taking care of ourselves. Maybe we're hungry and depleted in some way. And so we have to take care of the body. We also have to examine the quality of our thoughts. So much of what we feel, we have to go deeper. What am I believing about this situation that's informing these emotions? And so what the book points to is how do we bring and reintegrate and rebalance the experience of all three of these, the gut center, the emotional center, and the head center. And I think it's the combination of those things that really comprise what we mean when we say emotional intelligence in terms of defining what it really is comprised of.
Yeah. You have a quote in here by Parker Palmer. I don't know who Parker Palmer is exactly.
Yeah, he's an author, and several years back, somebody turned me on to one of his books called Let Your Life Speak and Searching for the Voice of Vocation. And I devoured that book. I love his writing.
Well, the quote that you use in your book, I loved it. I highlighted it. Our deepest calling is to grow into our own authentic selfhood, whether or not it conforms to some image of who we ought to be, keyword there. As we do so, we will not only find the joy that every human being seeks, we will also find our path of authentic service in the world. I love that. And then yes. You put this in italics is what awareness is all about. This is emotional intelligence. Spot on. Yes. Yeah.
I love that quote too. That's why, that's obviously why I included it, but I'm glad that spoke to you. That's the path, you know, for people who really want to pursue what that means to be emotionally intelligent. I think Parker Palmer nails it. I think that's what the Enneagram work points to, is kind of what I was saying earlier, which is, how do we recover the lost parts of ourselves? How do we recover and heal the parts of ourselves that we've put away from conscious awareness and substituted with this mask? And it's the pursuit of healing those wounded places and finding wholeness and choosing to bravely re-enter our authentic values and who we really are, the essence of who we really are. That's going to set us on the path of what real success looks like, real contentment and fulfillment. And it's hard because, for many reasons. One is, our egos formed to protect us, and they serve us, and they served us well. They wouldn't be so rigid and formed all over us if it didn't work, right? Like, it worked for us. But as Carl Jung says, and I'll paraphrase, what works for you in the morning of life will work against you in the afternoon of life. So these strategies as a young person really probably helped you. And then you get to a place in life where you start looking in the rearview mirror and you start seeing more and more little fender benders back there. And you start why is this strategy of mine not working the way that it used to work? And if you're experiencing that, that's the invitation to say, can I start to remove the mask?
And I would even question strategy of mine, because is it really our strategy that's messing us up, or the strategy that was imposed on us by an egocentric society? Are we rediscovering who we are? Because, you know, you look at children and they're so carefree and they're not very careful, right? Yeah. So the ego definitely serves to protect, but I do believe that it's been strengthened far beyond its value. And that's where we've really messed up and lost our way and strayed from the source quite a bit.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think, with the Enneagram, when you do more advanced work with it, it'll point you back to what's called the virtue of your persona, right? So the virtue of your type. So the theory being essentially that we, our type in its truest form lives out of this virtue, but in personality, it lives in the exact opposite, like this reaction, and creates what's known as the emotional vice of our personas. And that becomes the dominant experience. So I'll just give a couple examples. So for like Enneagram ones, who are often known as the improvers or the perfectionists, they set about, you know, the virtue of their type. Let me back up. The virtue of their type is serenity. That's their truest expression. But in their lived experience, just being who they were, the ability to make mistakes, the ability to appreciate a world that's not perfect, that wasn't going to be okay. They somehow internalized messages, real or perceived, that the world had to be made better, that they weren't good enough, they had to be better. And so the persona starts to come, the ego starts to come and creates this almost conditioned obsession with making things better and making themselves better. And so they have this very high standard that they can never live up to, and the world can never live up to. So the vice becomes the opposite of serenity. It becomes anger. Yet they believe that anger is not an appropriate quote unquote good emotion. So they try to bottle it up and it sort of leaks out of them as a little bit of resentment. And they think that if they can improve themselves or others or the world enough, they'll finally recover the serenity that was lost. Mm-hmm. And the reality is they have, the only way to recover serenity is to do less, to realize they don't have to perfect anything, that they themselves are good enough the way they are, that there's beauty in brokenness, that imperfections aren't necessarily bad. And when they finally can start to internalize that, then you can watch the one let go of the anger and reclaim the serenity that is who they were before the world told them who they needed to become. And I could go through, we don't have time, all nine types and share with you exactly the kind of internalized messages that took that person from virtue to vice.
Mm. You have so many examples in here as well. And then you break down, you know, their core motivations, the wounding message, superpower, focus of attention, communication style, physical profile, center of intelligence. I mean, it really does help people understand and explore. I've never taken the Enneagram before. Mm. I'd heard the name, but I didn't know what it was until last year, and I still haven't taken it.
Do you want to? I'll give you a link.
That would be really cool. I'm going to say that I probably am a one. As I was reading through your book, I was trying to figure out which number I might mm-hmm. be. And I had extreme anger issues for the longest time. And I spoke to some people and I cannot remember the name of this thing, but pretty much they're like very intuitive readers. I cannot remember the name of it, but this one lady looks at me, she goes, "You have a rage cage inside of you."
Hmm.
But I never acted out in front of her or anybody she knew. She was just, "I just detect rage inside of you," but I did not project that rage. And it was more about serenity and finding that inner peace. And sorry, I'm going to make this about me for just a split second. But yesterday I went into the woods, put up my hammock to work on my book. And I was just hoping for insights to flood in to help me write this book. And what came to me was something completely different, because I always go out when I meditate and do this work and ask a question of the universe. And it was, "Please kill my ego," right? Mm. "I know it's hindering me. I know it's getting in the way." And I sat there waiting for these insights to come to me and nothing happened, which is very unusual. And so then I started questioning, am I being punished, right? Because I'm trying to create something for the world to help change and shift everything. And then it came to me, this isn't about them. This is about you.
Mm.
You need to figure out you, and then you can help other people if they want your help. But your job isn't to enforce or intrude into other people's lives. It is your self-discovery journey, and others can benefit from you discovering yourself.
Yes.
And when I got home and I just took a shower, something about a shower, you know, things just come to you. And I'm like, I get it now. But then I was like, oh, I get it. Now what? Right. Mm. It was kind of like a mission complete. I figured it out, but I always know there's other things to discover. It's a rediscovery process and being okay with that. And living moment to moment. But it's so hard to explain that to other people who are still living from the superficial level of understanding that is the ego that's going to corrupt everything. And you also talk about that. That's why I resonate with this book so much. You have amazing information in here, amazing information, but it's the connection you have to the material and understanding how it's being taught and how it's being, quote unquote, understood, or should I say interpreted by the masses, is going to keep us in this feedback loop of confusion and feeling lost, because we're not going into the depths. We're staying at the superficial level.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that story. And I love what you said in terms of your realization, because, you know, one of the best ways I think we can contribute to help heal the whole world is to heal ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. Because nobody wants, everybody's on their own path.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us want somebody intruding on our journey.
No.
But yet when we're on that path, we gravitate towards the people who we can intuitively understand are where we want to be or where we're striving to be, right? We see ourselves, or we hate those people, right? It depends. Like if you have a fixed mindset, then you're going to hate seeing what you want in other people because you feel like you can't obtain it.
Yeah.
But then you have a growth mindset and you're like, oh, I see myself in them. I want what they have. I want them to help me discover it.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. Yeah. And then just the interactions you have when you reconnect and heal the broken parts of yourself, you just show up in the world in a way that you have, you might not have any idea how, you know, how much more positive of an, you know, impact you have on strangers that you come across because you have recovered some of that serenity and you are, you know, growing and moving beyond your ego. And that just, like you said, invites everybody in, but it just, it spreads the healing in a way, right? Yeah. Even people who aren't actively pursuing it. It just, you know, if we had.
You radiate that.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are the conversations that are hard. Again, they're hard to have in business context and things, but the truth is, and I mentioned this in the book as well, you know, if we were all on healing journeys, we probably wouldn't need to talk about emotional intelligence. It almost feels to me sometimes that the emotional intelligence conversation is because we can't talk about the real stuff. So we're like, and this real stuff over here that you're not really aware of and that you haven't healed is actually causing a lot of damage in the world. And so we're going to like try to get you an emotional intelligence coach, and we're going to try to do all these things so you can, again, white knuckle some changes and try to show up in the world in a more effective way. But we haven't gotten down to what's really driving that behavior. And you haven't either. It's in the shadows so often. It's so deep in the shadows that we don't see it, and we don't see that we don't see it.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
You have three parts to this book. And so you talk about raising our awareness, which is essentially what you just mentioned, right? We have to raise our awareness before we can discover this about ourselves. And so these five, you have self-perfection, self-expression, interpersonal relationships, decision-making, and stress management. Do you see that in any particular order, or can all that happen simultaneously?
Well, they're all interdependent and they're not linear, but I will say, so I start with self-perception because how we see ourselves will inform everything else, right? So we intentionally start there. And so I look at through the lens of the Enneagram, how each type in ego might naturally perceive themselves versus what they can, how they can recover a clearer self-perception when they do the work. And then that leads to self-expression. So I know this sounds a little linear, but these two are somewhat, right? So how we see ourselves will directly impact how we express ourselves, right? And then all of that will completely influence and inform our interpersonal relationships and our decision-making. And then the last one, and by the way, I only called it stress management because that's what the tool that I use to frame this around calls it. I don't really like the term stress management. Just like I don't like time management. You can't really manage time, but you know, for stress, how do we increase our capacity to understand and handle the stressors that come at us? And that's what I kind of focus on. And stress becomes incredibly important because if the stress piece is unmanageable, it will erode all the other stuff we just mentioned, right? So they're all interdependent, and it's really about learning to bring balance between all five of these scales. But yeah, that becomes the center point of the book because those scales are widely studied, tested, and validated measures of emotional intelligence. And so I wanted to look at those through the lens of the Enneagram and the lens of the ego and the lens of recovery and the lens of healing.
How do you feel about, because I know the Enneagram is an assessment. And I really like the DISC assessment, and I like, there's one very similar to the DISC. I can't think of the name of it. Those I'm okay with. But I have to say, I'm not a huge fan of emotional intelligence assessments. What are your thoughts on emotional intelligence assessments?
Well, it's a mixed bag for me.
Because if answered truthfully, right? Like if someone has self-awareness and they ask or answer the questions, I feel like it would be fairly accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel like a lot of the questions are subjective. Like how would you respond within that situation is likely, I feel like, how many people would respond. And I say this because a lot of people have came to me and said, oh yeah, I've taken the emotional intelligence assessment and I'm very emotionally intelligent. And I get to know them and I'm like, I don't know what assessment you took, but
yeah,
you know,
I mean, listen, assessments. So the Enneagram has an assessment, but most assessments out there, by the way, for your listeners, I will say, do not take any free online Enneagram assessments. Do not trust those. I've spent a great deal of time undoing the damage of people believing something that some online test told them that is not accurate whatsoever. There's only a couple of tests that I actually trust for their validity. And all these other psychometric tests, listen, I'm certified in them. I use them. I think they can be helpful, but all of these you according to you assessments usually don't produce much insight. Most of the time when I've used an assessment in the emotional intelligence space, I sit down with the person, they go, oh yeah, I'm not surprised by that, right? Something that's like really off, you know, maybe too high, too low. They know it. They just don't know how to change any of it really. And then we go too quickly, or what tends to happen in the coaching process is you try to go too quickly to very rational, logical processes for changing behavior, like we've been talking about. And that's not what's going to really change behavior. So I don't think they produce a lot of eureka moments, right? They can be helpful in the sense that, oh, I didn't realize that I'm a little out of balance here. I didn't realize I can see where there's some opportunity to pay more attention. And so at least it's a good starting place to say, I've reflected back this information from the inventory. And now you can choose if you want to pay more attention to what you've seen on that test. But like I said, I don't really see many people feeling very surprised by it. And so it leaves you in this quandary of like, well, you already know this stuff is out of whack, right? You already know, for example, maybe your self-perception is really low a lot of times, but you don't have to change it. And the test itself isn't going to tell you how to really change it. It's going to give you some, again, very logical, practical tips. But if you're not seeing yourself with, you know, love and compassion and empathy, you know, there's nothing about that process is probably going to change that. If you're under chronic stress and that's showing up on the test, you probably already know that you're really stressed, and there's probably not a lot there that's going to really change that. And again, that was my motivation for doing this book, is this is a good starting point. Like this framework is a good starting point. Like I said, it's kind of a tested, validated framework, but I think the real work is way beneath that. And so useful to a point, but it's only the starting point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, information is necessary for the learning process, but it's not the end all be all.
Mm-mm. Yeah. Well, the same thing with the Enneagram. Yeah. You learn your Enneagram type and stop there. Then you really, there's not a lot of, in fact, it can actually be detrimental, because if you sort of just learn the sort of generic attributes of a particular type and then, you know, talk about them at a cocktail party, it doesn't probably do much for your life other than create a little, you know, conversational banter. And what can be dangerous is then people can take a little bit of what they know and unintentionally maybe weaponize it against friends who mm-hmm. are of a different type. And I don't think that's what the Enneagram is for at all. I think it should be creating in us, because it's not a tool that just shows you about how different people behave, maybe differently than us, or even think differently than us. It's really getting into core motivations that are informed in part by core fears and wounding messages. And it's a vulnerable kind of experience to work with the Enneagram. And so what it should do, and I really emphasize these ethics when I teach workshops, is it should produce in you the response of deep relational compassion and empathy and care. And you should never, jokingly or otherwise, weaponize somebody's type against them. And it should produce in you, for yourself, a lot of curiosity and self-friendship to set you on the path of questioning some of the stories that informed the wounding behavior messages that led to some of the ego formation and has kept you at a distance from yourself, right? Like it should all produce compassionate self-inquiry and interpersonal interactions. And I certainly hope that's what people feel and are encouraged to do from reading this book.
Do you primarily work within organizations, or do you do a blend of working with individuals plus organizations?
Yeah, a blend. And I have fun doing both. I kind of have a slightly different approach, you know, in organizational contexts. I think my favorite is after a workshop, whether it's professional or in a more personal setting, is when you do a sort of one-to-one coaching with somebody afterwards who's had some breakthrough moments and they want to start this sort of journey, like what's next for me. And that's where I really love it, because you can feel, I feel in them the moment that I felt in myself when I had that like light bulb of like, okay, I've just scratched the surface of something here and I'm ready to go. Let's find out more.
What was that shift for you? Do you remember what that aha breakthrough was that kind of encouraged you to go deeper?
Yeah, well, so like the story I shared at the beginning about not being able to name my own feelings, mm-hmm. and yet because my Enneagram type actually uses a lot of feelings, but it directs feeling outward towards others. So being pretty perceptive at what other people might feel more and more accurately be able to define that than I can in myself. That was unsettling. So I was like, I don't want to be at this much of a distance from my own emotional experience. I don't like that. And then as I opened the book with, I had out of the blue, life-changing anxiety attack several years ago while driving at about 70 miles an hour. And having never experienced anything like that before, I thought it was a cardiac event. And so I'm trying to make my way to the side of the interstate and dialing 911 on myself. And I'm in a strange part of town and I stopped the car and my instinct was to get out and pace. And that's probably not what you do in a cardiac event, but I somehow wanted to get my body moving in rhythm with this sort of erratic heartbeat. And by the time the ambulance has arrived, which was pretty quick, everything has sort of calmed down. And I was feeling pretty foolish and embarrassed and still concerned that it was a cardiac thing. They did an EKG and some other things and they told me to go to the hospital. I declined. And that was a moment where it didn't take long for me to recognize that, oh my gosh, that was an anxiety attack. And why did I have it? I was actually in a fine mood when I was driving down the freeway. Nothing had happened. I wasn't feeling conscious stress. Connecting back to my earlier story of not being able to name my own emotional experience, I can tell you exactly what it was. It's years and years of repressed emotions that I wasn't connected to. And at my body yelled at me that day and it sounded an alarm. And at that moment, I didn't feel like I had a choice but to start the process of waking up to all the denied parts of myself and figuring out what is going on. That was quite scary.
Yeah. I resonated with that so much when I read it because I too suffer from panic attacks that came out of the blue. I would be perfectly fine. And the scariest one, though, I'd never had one driving before. And I was driving in Center City, Charlotte, where there's one-way roads. People are already trying to get around you. And I started to feel, you know, the panicky feeling, my breath. I felt like I couldn't catch it. And then I started to get tunnel vision. My vision started to go and it started to get blacker and blacker and blacker. And I'm driving and I'm like, oh my gosh. So I called my mom while I was on the phone. I'm like, Mom, just stay with me. I don't want to freak you out, but something's happening. I think it's just another panic attack. But every time you have another one, it always feels like you're dying again. You know what it feels like, but at the same time, you're like, well, maybe this is different. Mm-hmm. And so I found a parking garage to go into. but it does. It feels like you're dying. And when I reflect back on that, what I realize, much like you, I was someone who always felt like I had to keep it together for other people. And so in those hyper stressful situations, I was buttoned up and everybody would say, how can you be so calm? How are you this well put together? But then when everything was safe, that was when my body was like, okay, all of that stuff you suppressed is now going to come out because it has to come out.
Yeah.
So I resonate so much with that. Yeah. And I hate that you had to have that experience, especially being on the interstate going 70 miles an hour. And I'm sure, like, I can also speak to the feeling of feeling embarrassed, like, you know, not realizing that it was a panic attack, calling 911, but it is serious in that moment, you know, because you don't know what's going on.
Well, I never thought I would tell the story, let alone write about it and put it in a book. But and I wouldn't have until probably years later, when I'd gone through a lot of recognizing kind of how valuable it was, you know, terrifying. And I wish it hadn't had to happen. But in some ways, it was a wake up call.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love this. So what is the biggest takeaway that you want readers to get from reading this book? Let's say for a new person, let's do a new person and let's do someone who may be familiar with the Enneagram, but isn't familiar with pairing it with emotional intelligence. So first, someone who knows nothing about either, what do you hope they get out of it? And then what do you hope someone who is somewhat familiar with the Enneagram, but not emotional intelligence, would get out of it?
Yeah. Well, I tried to write it for both of those audiences. I tried to straddle that line. So somebody that had no familiarity could get enough in the early chapters to understand the framework and hopefully resonate with one of the types a bit and start to then feel curious to read more about that type as they go through. So I hope because the Enneagram is uniquely positioned as a tool for discovering often unconscious motivations, I hope that somebody connects to just some parts of themselves that maybe they didn't realize were responsible for so much of the way they see and make sense of the world. You know, that there's just something that opens up in them a little bit. And then for the person that may have studied the Enneagram at length, or somewhere in between, my hope is that looking at the Enneagram overlaid on top of a system that is proven to be measuring attributes that will really help you, if you can bring them into balance, both in your personal and professional lives, you'll then be able to overlay these sort of motivations and fears and defense mechanisms that the Enneagram reveals to make real conscious strides towards creating more balance. Again, coming back to what I said earlier about the body and the mind and the heart, and that you'll have a roadmap for how to reintegrate and rebalance all three of those.
I love it. Love it. Thank you so much, Scott.
Thank you, Brittany.
I'm going to make sure that everybody can find this easily. So the book will be in the show notes, but also you have a podcast as well.
I do. I have a leadership podcast. I co-host with a good friend of mine. It's called the Evolving Leader Podcast. And we interview people from neuroscience and coaches of elite sport and psychologists. And we come at the leadership conversation in hopefully never in a trite or predictable way. And so we're trying to push the leadership conversation in new directions.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you.
I'm really excited to see this book be published, because I thoroughly enjoyed it and I learned a lot from it. And it's very well laid out, and it has a blend of stories and data and diagrams that is easy to digest, but it's also very wholesome. So thank you.
And thank you for the work that you're doing in the world. I really appreciate it.
It is a pleasure. All day, every day. I love it. Thank you.